Amy Mann, to finish things out here at WFMU with a quick little tune from Bachelor Number 2, Just Like Anyone. Jeffrey Gurumil Yunupingu gave us a piece called Jarimiri from a self-titled album, Gurumil. And he's coming to the U.S. He's from New Zealand and going to be at Joe's Pub sometime in June. Yola Tango did When It's Dark from Popular Songs, and beginning the set, Robin Hitchcock and the Venus Three with Ordinary Millionaire from the new one, Propeller Time. And that does it for me. Good to be back. I'm Irene Trudell. I'll be back next week at 3 o'clock. And this is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. On the web at WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Too Much Information is next.
Thank you. I'm riding the F train, and I'm sitting across from two women. It's early in the afternoon, so the train is not too crowded. Both of the women sitting across from me are reading magazines. One is reading the January 25th issue of The New Yorker, and the other is reading the February 1st issue of People. The woman reading The New Yorker is a brunette, and the woman reading People is a blonde. I'm immediately drawn to the brunette. She's got shoulder-length hair, full lips, and she's wearing a stylish black trench coat cinched not too tight around the waist. The blue sweater underneath looks like it came from a thrift store, and it goes well with her off-white kids. Her jeans have these little faux rips that sort of fan up her thighs like peacock feathers. Blah. These effectively end my reverie, and as the train pulls into West 4th Street, a terrifying thought bursts into my brain. What if I am attracted to this woman simply because she's reading The New Yorker? I give the blonde a closer look. She's also got shoulder-length hair, but it's pulled back in a cute, messy bun. She's got thin lips and big eyes. She's wearing knee-high black leather boots, but no pants, so I can see that she's very layered up, leg warmers on top of two pairs of tights. And while I think her baggy black corduroy shorts clash with her black lacy peacoat, I do like how her neon lavender wool sweater poofs out from the sleeves of the jacket. It gives the illusion that she's wearing oven mitts. It was troubling, because after taking this closer look at the blonde, I became unsure of my snap judgment regarding the brunette. Perhaps I am wired to check out a woman reading The New Yorker magazine over a woman reading People. Now, I haven't really dated that many blondes, and I've never really given it that much thought as to why. My earliest memory involving a blonde is from the sixth grade. It was the first day of school, and our homeroom teacher informed us that she'd met her husband in the sixth grade. They'd sat next to one another. So, look around, kid, she giggled, because you never know. I was sitting next to Heather Ottenbright, who was popular and blonde. She took a book out of her bag and stood it upright on its side, between us on the desk. Perhaps this moment of cruelty is the root of my indifference towards blondes. But, like I said, I'd never really given the issue that much thought. But as the train pulls into 14th Street, I give it a lot of thought, and I realize that even though the majority of the women I've gone out with have not been blonde, and we're talking about 98% here, I do need both hands and one foot to count the ones I can easily remember. So, I think it's fair to say that I am not attracted to the brunette because of some anti-blonde bias. But, perhaps, it is the opposite. Perhaps I have a built-in thing for brunettes. The first brunette I really go out with is named Jennifer, Jennifer number one. I was 19 years old, and I'd just moved to Bozeman, Montana. I was cleaning rooms at the Rainbow Motel for the summer. I didn't know anybody in town. I was just cooling my heels till college started in the fall. A few nights a week, I'd go out to the coffee shops and bars that didn't ask for ID, but for the most part, my feeble attempts at meeting people were disastrous. But then, one afternoon as I was putting the vacuum cleaner away, the owner of the Rainbow Motel hands me a note. "Some girl left this for you," he said. It was from Jennifer, the girl I'd tried to pick up the night before at the coffee shop. I must have told her I worked at the motel. I also told her how much I liked libraries, because in the note, she offered to drive me to the library in Livingston, which she said was the best library in the area. A few days later, we'd not only been to the library, but we'd also been camping. And in a few weeks, we were together all the time. We only had a few months. At the end of the summer, she'd be leaving for college, to Portland, Oregon, to attend Lewis and Clark. And even though I was only 1 year older, her father was extremely uncomfortable about our relationship. It was as if he thought I was going to ruin everything at the last minute, keep her in Bozeman, knock her up, or even worse, get her to start cleaning motel rooms with me. But the truth is, it was just a summer romance. And on Labor Day, she left. I tried to pretend that this was no big deal, and we would talk on the phone every few days. But the distance between us rapidly opened up, and thus, I decided to pay her a visit over Columbus Day weekend. This did not go well. I was so jealous of her new life and all her new friends, I didn't want anything to do with them. I just sulked in her dorm room, which is where she left me on Saturday night after we had a tearful argument. She went out with her new friends, dancing. I went through her diaries. I learned that she actually hadn't wanted me to come visit her, and that on Monday, she was going to tell me that it was over. I was mortified, mostly because I barely rated a page in her diary, whereas there were pages and pages devoted to bad poetry. On one page, she'd written, "Will I be the next Emily Dickinson?" "No," I wrote in large capital letters. And then I grabbed my things and caught the bus back to Montana. We never spoke again. After this, I decided I'd replace her with a new Jennifer. There was one in my American history class. And so I took her to the library in Livingston, and then back to my place, where we drank mint tea and ate peanut butter M&Ms and stayed up late talking about our favorite songs. This is, of course, how it went down with Jennifer number one. In less than a year, I was up to Jennifer number five. I had the system down to a science. But then, one night, I refused to make out with a girl because her name was Katie, and it hit me that I'd become a ridiculous man. And so I brought the Jennifer thing to a close. But the point of the story is that only one of these Jennifers was a brunette. Two had black hair, one was a redhead, and the other was a blonde. And I liked them all the same. I think this is sufficient evidence that I do not have a brunette thing. Back to the train. As we pull into 23rd Street, I try something new. I try imagining the brunette is actually a blonde reading The New Yorker, and the blonde is actually a brunette reading People. But I can't pull it off. I'm always conscious that I'm pretending to see a blonde when I really see a brunette, and that I'm pretending to see a brunette when really I'm looking at a blonde. And then there are the magazines. I am always conscious that the brunette is reading The New Yorker, and the blonde is reading People. But I push forward with the experiment, and I start mixing and matching. I replace the thin lips of the blonde with the full lips of the brunette. I use the blonde's leg warmers to cover the fake holes of the brunette's jeans. I switch the blue sweater with the neon lavender sweater, and I swap the Keds for the knee-high boots. I take the makeup off the blonde, and I apply it to the brunette. And then I take the dark nail polish from the brunette, and I shine up the boots belonging to the blonde. I put fake holes in the corduroy shorts of the blonde, and I poof out the sleeves of the brunette's blue sweater. I take the leg warmers off the blonde and pull them down over the face of the brunette, and I take the trench coat off the brunette, and I use it like a straitjacket on the blonde. Okay, now I know this must sound very twisted, but I assure you this is all for a good cause. I mean, I took feminist film theory in college, and I know all about the male gaze and its destructive power. In fact, I was one of only two males in the whole film program who bothered to take this one-time course offering. And I was the one who participated in the class discussions and paid attention. The other guy in the class, Daniel, he did not. He would come to class wearing these loud Russ Meyer t-shirts, and he was always calling the professor sweetie. And for his final paper, he actually got up in front of the room and delivered a lecture entitled Betty and Veronica, Covert Lesbian Erotica in Full Color. The professor told me she was so frightened of this guy, she gave him an A, which I found strange because I only received a B for my paper on the matriarchal Western. But it wasn't that big a deal, and besides, it was in this paper that I truly came to understand the power of the male gaze and how it can still thrive in a matriarchal system like the one in Samuel Fuller's movie, 40 Guns. But anyway, the point here is that on the train, my gaze is trained on the universal, not the particular, and I'm trying to answer a question. Why am I attracted to the brunette rather than the blonde? And so, when the train pulls out of 34th Street, I try one more thing. I imagine the blonde is the one reading the New Yorker magazine, and the brunette is the one reading People. And pow! There is a blinding flash of light, and the truth is made manifest. I'm now more attracted to the blonde.
Last week, I came to New York to help Ken and Andy produce 7 Second Delay live from the UCB Theater in Chelsea. We booked all of our guests from an ad on Craigslist, and one of them was Jeannie. She's a psychic with the greatest website URL ever, www.abcdesp.com.
Please welcome Jeannie Reed.
I guess you knew I'd say that. That's just a sample of the kind of zingers we'll be hearing.
And Andy, I promised Jeannie.
The iceberg.
I did promise Jeannie yesterday that you would be highly respectful.
He wasn't.
I could see, actually, but that started to lift about 3 or 4 months ago.
About 3 or 4 months ago, exactly right.
Oh, you know, don't BS me now, Andy.
Oh, okay. Wait, let me think.
You can't BS a BSer, Andy.
No, that's not true.
Wait,
that's
I'm
not
sure.
What I meant. That's not what I meant
to
say.
I didn't come here to entertain anybody.
Jeannie did not like being the butt of Ken and Andy's jokes, and she was especially mad at me. On Thursday, I got a nasty email from her, and it made me feel terrible, because I was hoping to get some psychic advice. So I came up with a plan. I could interview her for the other radio program I work for, this one, and I could sneak in some questions about my situation. So I went to her apartment in Midtown. Okay, 1, 2.
Can I have you introduce yourself?
My name is Jeannie Reed. I live and work in Manhattan. I'm a professional psychic, and I've been doing this for 26 years.
That sounds nice.
Okay, good. I'm trying to get people's heads straight about what psychics do when they're real, and so that the ridicule I experienced the other night on your station doesn't happen so often anymore. But, you know, I've been hearing it all my life. So I'm not a dumb person, you know. I have a college degree at a 3.8 grade point average. I study. My left brain is really, really there. It took me a long time to relax and just let things kind of come. But come they do. I'm not kind of bragging, but just as an example, I was always tested an IQ at 129. So now I'm using the I Ching for about 20 years, and I have a chance to be tested again. And as I was doing the IQ test, I'm thinking, I do this. This is how I think when I do the I Ching. And the score was 145. Now, IQs are supposedly fixed. Well, maybe they're not fixed if your right brain kicks in and you develop your a whole ability to think and perceive and reason, then everything is possible. All you have to do is open somehow. You know, the phone ringing, but when you answer it, it's like dead. Well, that's someone saying, hey, I'm here. I don't know who necessarily, but I know that. So I believe we read from our guts and our right brain. Now, the right brain draws pictures, but I believe the right brain is the source of psychic ability. I believe that's our antenna and our signal receiver and broadcaster. I walked down the street one day, and it was Strange Street. It won't work if you're familiar with the street. And I said, this is about 15 years ago, will I ever hear from Bob again? And it mattered. And I get to the corner, and there's a big red heart painted on the sidewalk with a big black slash through it. And I knew, and I didn't. Yeah, I never heard from Bob again. So there it was.
That makes me think about New York City. You know, I've moved to Chicago full time. This is a city where I just feel like the streets are sparkling up at me.
Oh, good.
And everyone's smiling at me, and it just like, I don't know, it just is like maybe probably the place I belong.
Is that a different feel? Is that different from how you feel in Chicago?
Yep.
Yeah. Carlos Castaneda, The Adventures of Don Juan, he's a wizard and a shaman, and he wrote these books in maybe the 70s. He said, do this experiment, because everywhere in the world, in every single location, in every major location, there's a good spot and a bad spot. So he said, take a room in your house and sit in every square inch of the room. And so I did. And there was a really bad spot, and there was a really good spot. Likewise, somebody moved to Philadelphia, and he kept getting mugged. And somebody said to him, duh, that's not your place, man. They'll kill you there. So he left. So if you feel that way about Manhattan or New York, and you feel that way about Chicago, then for sure, trust your instincts. We don't do that enough. The elephants tried to leave the tsunami area the day before. You got out of Chicago. You were right before. There's no difference. You just have to listen to your little voice, which most people ignore. They don't trust it. They don't trust themselves on a grand scale. They have other psychological things going on where they have no faith in themselves. So if you don't trust yourself, you won't trust your own psychic ability, which I believe, of course, we all have. When the World Trade Centers were knocked down, I was distressed. And then, like, the next day, I did the cards, and I saw there was a man who was financing and leading the operation. And the U.S. government, the next day, day three, I guess, said Osama bin Laden, and a lot of photographs of the terrorists were in the paper. They had these photos already. Where does that come from? But anyway, and they said he was somewhere in Afghanistan. So I drew a funny map of, I looked up Afghanistan, and I kind of just drew a map. And I did a spread, and the card for that man that I had found fell in where the Tora Bora Mountains would be. That's where bin Laden was found to have been. And I knew. Now, there's a great counterterrorism expert in America named Brian Michael Jenkins, who is now at the RAND. Well, last I knew, he was at the RAND Corporation, a think tank. So I've sent him 4 or 5 pages, single-space typed, of information. And about 90% of it, from what I know now, was accurate. I have also volunteered myself and just sent stuff to cops, to judges, to whoever I thought might be useful, especially when it's a cold case, it involves a child, and there's a grieving somebody out there, and they just want to know. I spent 3 years as a private detective, so I kind of know my way. I won't say I know my way around this stuff, but I do have an instinct, a good instinct, for finding people and knowing things. And so this tarot and I Ching is simply an extension of what NCIS does, or the crime scene people do. They have a fingerprint, I have a card. What I do healthcare-wise is I diagnose illness. So people who sit here not knowing that they're walking around even with AIDS, and I send them to doctors. And I try to be not scare them, but I send them to doctors.
But is this a solution, you know, for people like myself who don't have health insurance?
People without health care benefits, I don't know what to do, to be honest with you. It's really a struggle. I don't have an employer. I have to struggle. Blue Cross in New York is $900 and some a month. And there's no group going to absorb that for me. I spent all these years studying and learning all this stuff, and it's useless on me. I can maybe sometimes get a general idea of an answer to a question, but the only thing what I do is good for is to help other people figure out their lives. I can't work for me. It's useless.
Thank you. My name is Pike Malinowski. I'm a poet, and I'm going to read you a Google poem. My poem is about a banana. It's kind of depressing and not very good, but it's something. My poem is about people fighting over the phone. My poem is about the White Nancy, a monument on the hill above Bollington, and its provenance, over which there is some uncertainty. My poem is about snakes, sliding snakes, scaly and scary, big, brown, bad, and bulky. My poem is about me and for all those who think alike. My poem is about a young woman writing to her lost child. My poem is about issues of proto-fascism and the dangers of democracy, which I see fraying every day. And my poem is about what you believe. No, I mean what I believe and the differences I see between people in the street and the colors in the skies. All my poem is about the void I feel in the pit of my heart. My poem is about a banana who walked away from the store with his friend the apple. My poem is about someone falling in love and maybe being rejected and falling again. That's basically it. My poem is about Linkin Park and the guys that play in the band. My poem is called Music. My poem is about emotional compromises and self-deception. My poem is about the color and mood as the seasons change. My poem is about the sea I love, all my spare time I spend in the ocean, surfing a wave that will fit my motion. My poem is about another figure who's a hero to me, Congresswoman Barbara Jordan. My poem is about a girl, me, talking about all her friends, where they're from and what they mean to her. My poem is about how we should take time to see God in everything and help others see him too. My poem is for kids and about how they have fun, but mostly my poem is about freedom. My poem is about a Christian longing for the heavenly home. My poem is about Mick Jagger. My poem is about, well, the darker side of life. My poem is about how my experiences with bullying have helped me to realize that I am a stronger person than the bullies. My poem is about time, when night comes, how it gets dark, etc. My poem is about the internal conflicts faced by an individual when falling in love.
Thank you for that, Pike. So explain what a Google poem is and how you came to start writing Google poetry.
Well, I was a real poet. You know, since I was maybe 15, I was writing poetry, real poetry, with real words of my own. And I discovered the internet. I was kind of slow. I was still actually writing on a manual typewriter until 98 or 99. And then I discovered Google, and I discovered the idea of using other people's voices to write poetry. And I think it might have something to do with the fact that I was making radio, and radio, you know, if you make a vox pop in radio, you go into the street, you ask people the same question, and you get 10 different responses. In Google, you type in one question and you get, you know, a million different responses. And so I started writing poetry that way. So, for example, in this poem, I typed in "my poem is about," and, you know, which gave me all the answers from the people who felt that it was important for them to explain what their poem was about, which is a certain segment of poets. And, you know, I'm not poking fun of them, actually. I enjoy this poem. I enjoy the way they're trying to describe what their poem is about. And there's something innocent about that. There's something naive, and there's something fundamentally wrong about it also, because it's at sort of cross-purpose with the whole idea of writing a poem.
But how do you know which lines go together? Like, how one fits with that one?
That's the art of making this kind of poetry. Any kind of poetry is, you know, you have a feeling, it's just a gut feeling, you know. I think Google poem is the wrong word, because Google didn't write this poem. I wrote this poem. I composed a poem out of the hits that I got on Google. I think my beef or my issue with the term Google poem is also about Google is less innocent now. When I started writing Google poetry, it was a lot more innocent. I think it's, you know, you do a Google search now and most of the first hits that come up are from like spam crawlers, you know, software that they want to sell you something, or they want you to click on this thing or click on that thing. And
aren't those, in a sense, Google poems themselves?
No, they're not. They're not Google poems. They're robot poems. So they're created by, you know, spam bots.
Wouldn't the ultimate Google poem be a robot poem?
There's been experiments. There are people who've made robot poetry. And I don't, it's not very good, I don't think. You have to do a little better than that.
I travel a lot for a living, so I'm always looking for what to eat. I was at a bar, a pretty standard Americanized bar. It's actually one of the many fake Irish pubs in Shanghai. And fake Irish pubs are, at least in Asia, they're like the McDonald's of the drinking set. You know they're fake. You know, except in Hong Kong, they have real Guinness. You know that they're not really ever going to be authentic anything. They're not authentic Irish. They're not anything. But you know what? It's like a baseline. So I was there closing the place, as is my custom, and I started talking in broken both English and Mandarin to one of the guys in the back, who was a cook, but he could have just been a fixer for the place. Well, he could have been security. And what he said was, I was talking about a place I really loved in Shanghai. It was a Taiwanese chain, the same one I go to in LA. And he said, those dumplings are horrible. I have a long-running love of dumplings, pork dumplings. And he said, you need to go to this place. He couldn't tell me the name. He told me roughly where it was. And I put it down on my phone. And the next morning, I set out after sobering up and dealing with the hangover. I set out to find this place. I walk off Nanjing Lu. I walk north with my camera. I walk through a whole bunch of weird places where once you get a few blocks off the tourist areas of Shanghai, it's Shanghai. It's normal. So everyone is very, very confused to see a massive white guy with red hair walking around with a camera, basically just taking pictures of everything that moves. Eventually, I found the place. I go in. The place really doesn't have a sign, but you could tell what they had. You could tell this was the place because it was a little cleaner than the other places around it. I go in, there's a drunken traffic warden who insists on me drinking baijiu, Chinese wine. I didn't want to drink it, but I didn't want to offend them, so I was like laughing it off and very nice. I get these dumplings. They are transcendent. They are the best dumplings I've ever had. I mean, and I know my dumplings. These were good. I get another round. As I'm standing up to get another round, the traffic warden, who clearly wasn't doing anything with traffic or parking or whatever, starts to offer me cheap cigarettes. I don't take them, but, you know, I laugh it off. I shake his hand. I give him my name card even. I take his picture. Eventually, I leave this place. I come back out. There are people playing mahjong on the street where before there was nothing. And the entire neighborhood had changed while I was eating. it was actually one of the happiest times I've ever had in Shanghai, and I've spent a lot of time there because I got to see a whole bunch of things I wouldn't have seen otherwise. Well, the first time I really encountered the concept of if you like this, you would like that would be at McBean's record store where I grew up in Brunswick, Maine. There was a guy named Randy Bean who was a really curious character, but he was a really interesting guy, and he knew my father, and everyone knew everyone in my town. It was very small. And he would tell you, if you like this, you would like that. And the weird thing about it is that he was, I mean, Maine is a really white place. I actually got into, like, gangster rap and a few other things in the late 80s because I was young and, you know, stupid. It was amazing to me that he would actually say, well, you know, if you like this, you probably like this too. Now, I'm sure he was getting some of this off a list from the record distributor or something, but more often than not, he was right. I mean, he actually referred me in the right direction, so he knew my genre. He knew exactly what I would like, the rebellious sort of, you know, stick it to the man stuff. And it really worked, so I had a lot of respect for him. I eventually moved on to another record store run by younger people. But the principle was the same, you know? I mean, it was basically a situation where, you know, I would be told what to buy, and after a while, you'd gravitate towards those people that told you the better things to buy, but they were right. I prefer a person to an engine, which is strange because I program stuff, and I actually should probably prefer the taxonomy. I'm definitely a believer in technology. I'm definitely a believer in recommendation engines. But the biggest data point is what you buy. And there's no serendipity to that necessarily. They're really going from a very set formula. Like, you bought 20 books that were biographies. You know, 15 of those were about World War II. Thus, you're probably going to like this book that's also about those things. But it's really that sort of principle that you're dealing with keywords, filtering up towards what you've bought and trying to generate things that you don't already have. The one thing Randy Bean occasionally did at the music store, but you didn't really get it because he's still a salesman, you'd get that sort of like, you don't want that record. You really don't want to be doing this. And the thing that you don't see in any recommendation engine now is it never steers you away from anything. It always steers you towards something because it is sort of like a salesman in your pocket. It's always saying, hey, if you like this, you would like that. And for me, sometimes it's much more negative. It's, if you like this, then you're absolutely not going to like that. I need an opinionated app to guide you away from stuff as much as they guide you towards things. That's what interests me the most. In my heart, I do believe in the concept of recommendation engines because I think that an algorithm is possible. But I also believe that in some ways people are holding things back because there's not a good business model for them, which is why you're not going to get a recommendation app that says, you know what, this record really sucks. So, starting from scratch again, reconstructing my dream of a recommendation engine where I could somehow find a job where I could just travel the world walking the streets and finding the best place, and occasionally programming. If I were to design something for me personally, it would be basically only for me and I'm insane, but it would probably merge crime maps with food maps so that I could go to the most dangerous neighborhood possible that had the best food that I wouldn't get killed in. Thank you.
Okay, so how about you tell him in the recording?
Okay,
so
great.
We can make a note of that.
Great. Hi, Benjamin. Thank you. Andrew's a fabulous interviewer. Really good and articulate. She mentioned just now that you use music during the interviews, and I would really appreciate it if you wouldn't do that, because whatever music one chooses, it's not going to support in any way whatever I'm saying, because that music hasn't been written yet, basically. So if you cannot orchestrate the interview, I would really, really appreciate it. Confusion kind of arises when you don't really know what was the starting point. And if you go back to the starting point, then you start sorting through things again. It's the same thing with a filing system. If you have 1,000 pieces of paper and it's all over the place, you have to start sorting the papers into categories, and then you get back to the beginnings of the thing and you can recreate anything. So confusion can be dispelled by direction. We can provide psychic maps. Carl Jung said there is a universal unconscious. So below the subconscious mind, which remembers this life, there's an unconscious mind that remembers all our lives and our future lives. And at that point, at that place, he said, all of people are connected. And then physicists came along and said, string theory, everything in the universe is connected. So between those two things, I believe we can all tap into this stuff. 24 hours before an earthquake, animals tend to know and they leave. Some natural disaster, the animals are all taken off. Well, that tells me that probably we have psychic ability for the same reason, but it's been so overwhelmed by training the left brain to add, subtract, memorize history and dates and stuff. And here we're not doing anything. So when I teach tarot, I'm telling my students, I want you to draw a picture every day. I want you to look at clouds and see if you can find specific things. I want you to look at designs in marble and see, look for things that pop. I recently taught a class, and into the fifth class, only 10 hours, two people together decided to see what was going on with Oprah Winfrey. And 2 days before she announced she was leaving her show, they said, oh, look at this, Oprah Winfrey's changing her career, okay? Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston are engaged. We get them being divorced the day the engagement is announced. We see another woman coming into the picture, me and my little class at that time. So basically, this is simply by putting cards together in a certain way. Likewise, I discovered that certain combinations of cards equal mugging, murder, theft, suicide, incest, you name it. I had the courage to start checking this stuff out. There is a fabulous oracle called the I Ching, which was written in China thousands of years ago. I asked the I Ching once, I wanted to know the name of a doctor in another state that I wasn't familiar with that was important to me for an emotional reason. And I said, what's the doctor's name? And I got this line that said, he chops down a tree. And the doctor's name is Feldman, which is felling a tree. So basically, if you know how to use these oracles, which are, by the way, all around us, you can do amazing things. I once used Rilke. The German poet wrote a book of poems called the Duino Elegies for his lover. And for 6 months, I used the Duino Elegies as an oracle. Open, put my finger down on a spot and read the answer, read the line, and it was absolutely accurate. Maybe the internet was the tree in the garden of good and evil. And if you go out online, you need to know exactly what your question is so that when you find the answer, you know your question is being answered. I think the question about the internet and what can psychics do, it's not the right question. Psychic stuff depends on connections between me and somebody. Unfortunately, that's pretty hard to do. I mean, if I look at you in a very sweet way with a knife in my hand and say, I love you, you know, and that's done all the time. And if you need to hear the words, You're going to die of a stab wound. The internet is too anonymous. You can't have internet sex and be touched. It's not going to happen, not even virtually or avatar-wise or any other way. You need a body there, right? A pulse. So there are limits. And if everybody did that, there would be no more human race. And that's really what I have to say about that. The antidote to the information age is to get connected one-on-one again.
I get off the train at 42nd Street and I purchase two magazines. One copy of the January 25th issue of The New Yorker and one copy of the February 1st issue of People. I take them both into Bryant Park and I sit down at one of the iron tables near the fountain. This kind of data is actually quite valuable. And it's a little known fact, but the men and women working in the newsstands of New York City get paid under the table to collect this information. It's a black data market, of course, all illicit, but in pretty much every one of these newsstands, you'll find a wireless keypad stashed just out of view. These are used to record purchases and related information. For example, after I walked away, the clerk typed in male, Caucasian, 30-ish, and 1. The Consumer Attitude Index is a graded 1 to 10 scale, and thanks to the scowl on my face, I rated a 1. My experience on the subway had put me in a dark mood. Normally, I walk around with a smile on my face. There are many different opinions as to where this data ends up, but everyone's trying to get that extra edge. Amazon, iTunes, Pandora, Google, Facebook. All of these companies pay top dollar for black market data. Their recommendation engines are beasts that always need to be fed. And collaborative filtering works best when the data sets are large. The formula at the heart of collaborative filtering is actually pretty simple. It states, if you liked that, then you'll like this. And it's based on the idea that those who have agreed on something in the past will come to agree on something in the future. But turning this formula into an all-powerful algorithm is not simple. In fact, some would say that this is the philosopher's stone of our time. The company in the driver's seat is Netflix. 3 years ago, they created the $1 million Netflix Award Prize, a contest open to anyone with the goal of improving the Netflix Cinematch movie recommendation engine by 10%. Over 40,000 teams from 186 countries participated in this contest. The winning team, Belcore's Pragmatic Chaos, was comprised of software and electrical engineers, statisticians, and machine learning researchers from Austria, Canada, Israel, and the United States. And on September 21st, 2009, all seven members showed up in New York City to accept the prize at a ceremony at the Four Seasons Hotel. It was the first time they came together in person. The main driving force for this team's research is the all-out rejection of item-based filtering. In other words, you don't need to know a thing about what's in the movies themselves. All you need to care about is how the viewers rate the movies. For example, the fact that there's a piece on writer Neil Gaiman in the January 25th issue of The New Yorker and a piece on Jennifer Aniston in the February 1st issue of People is actually worthless data. But the fact that I was disappointed by the small amount of ink dedicated to Neil's recent engagement to Amanda Palmer does turn out to be important, and it could actually link up with the dissatisfaction People magazine readers are surely feeling in regards to the so-called profile of Jennifer Aniston. I mean, you can't really call it a 5 years later profile if you don't do an interview with her. Most of the teams that made it to the final rounds of the Netflix contest relied on user-based collaborative filtering rather than item-based filtering. There are two types of user-based collaborative filtering, the active and the passive. The best example of active collaborative filtering is Facebook. This is a site where users will proudly announce their likes for the world to see. And while you can usually assume that the books and movies and links a user posts on his or her Facebook wall are actually things this user cares about, it is a public system. And in public, we often say things we don't mean and things that are categorically false. For example, in public, I'd never admit that my New Yorker subscription lapsed 5 months ago. Not only would my coworkers question my ability to do my job, but my friends would make fun of me. But in truth, the high value I ascribe to the New Yorker doesn't really have anything to do with its cultural capital. It's basic, rooted in love and respect for my grandmother, who read it every week until her death last year at the age of 90. In order to win the $1 million Netflix prize, the Belcore Pragmatic Chaos team creatively used both active and passive collaborative filtering. They noted that some users would give lower ratings on Fridays versus Mondays, and that some users would only offer positive reviews on Sundays. Passive data is collected from us all the time now. It's not just when we purchase magazines from street vendors, but every time we go online. The time of day, the number of clicks we make, the number of seconds between keystrokes, the number of messages we delete without reading. All of this is added to the data pool. Of course, there are limitations to passive filtering as well. For example, my friend Tim enters the New Yorker cartoon caption contest every week. Every week he sends in the same caption, "F*** you." And you know, to tell you the truth, it's amazing how often this caption not only works, but works better than the caption that is eventually chosen as the winner. And while I do know for certain that the cartoon editors are in no way appreciative of Tim's continued support for the cartoon caption contest, you can see how a computer could easily be confused and mistake Tim's dedication for devotion. This episode of Too Much Information is called If You Like That. It was written and produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Andrea Salenzi and Bill Bowen. It featured Pike Malinowski, Sam Bailey, and Jeannie Reed. There's even more Too Much Information on the show page at WFMU.org, and you can also subscribe to the TMI podcast.
plastic, man. Ethnic, spelled with a K, that's the name of this track, from 1994, at least that's when this CD is from, Music with a K. And the interesting thing about listening to electronic music that's, you know, 15, 16, 20 years old on CD is that the compression has changed so much. This is what people refer to when they talk about loudness wars and all that. But it's actually really amazing. You pop in the Plastic Man CD alongside other new CDs and it sounds quiet. And then the track builds, and then when the full bass kicks, it just jumps up many dB. So he's essentially playing with a greater dynamic range, as were the masters and everybody at the production process. My name is DJ Rupture, and you're tuned into WFMU. This show is Mud Up. I'm going to be in the pilot seat for the next hour, and the ambient tune we started off with was brand new, out in a week or so on Mago. That was Oniotrix Point Never, a project by Daniel Lopatin, and the name of that song was Stress Waves.